What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
We have been working on this show over the last few months to intensely increase our coverage on the genocides happening across the globe, including in the Sudan and the Congo. Today, belatedly, and I'm going to keep taking responsibility for that, is our first segment in what will be ongoing coverage of the war-torn nation of the Congo. We are joined this morning by Maurice Carney, co-founder and executive director of the Friends of the Congo. Good morning, Maurice.
Good morning. Good morning, Dana. How you doing? Good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing, you know, all things considered, probably as good as everybody else. One breath at a time, my G. I'm lucky enough, Maurice, to have a base that listens pretty regularly. So we're all going to get educated together over the next weeks, months, et cetera.
So
I want to start basic, right? Because actually, I think it's really important. And I, for those of you listening, I would go to the Friends of the Congo website. It's really helpful the way the information is compiled and the way the history and the geography of the country is tied to the current political conditions. So I want to give you the opportunity to talk to my listeners about basic information about the Congo. Where is it located on the continent, right? Was it surrounded by, how big is it? And what are the resources that exist there? Like, what is the, if there was a free Congo, what could it, what could it do for Africa?
Oh my goodness.
I know, big questions to start, Let's start with the good, let's start with the dream.
Yeah, I mean, in speaking of that, if there was a free Congo, what would it do for Africa? You know, Patrice Emery Lumumba, and some of your listening audience may know, the first democratically elected prime minister of the Congo in 1960, he laid that out. He laid out what a free Congo would do for Africa. And he laid it out in concert with figures like Kwame Nkrumah. And Kwame Nkrumah, the president of Ghana, he wrote a book entitled The Challenge of the Congo. And for those of you who may be familiar with Kwame Nkrumah, he's often referred to as the father of Pan-Africanism, continental Pan-Africanism. He was influenced by Marcus Garvey. He went to Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, black, historically black school, and worked closely with W.E.B. Du Bois. And Kwame Nkrumah argued for, wrote about the United States of Africa, how Africa has to come together in order to assume its rightful place in the global landscape. And he laid that out under a vision of Pan-Africanism. And he saw Congo as being central to this vision. In fact, Kwame Nkrumah, president of Ghana at the time, Modibo Keita, president of Mali at the time, Ahmed Sekou Touré, president of Guinea, they all came together to organize around the United States of Africa. And Nkrumah saw Congo serving as the capital of the United States of Africa. Now, why? Well, the Democratic Republic of the Congo is literally and figuratively the heart of the African continent. If you envision the African continent like your body, Congo is the heart. It's a country the size of Western Europe, straddling the equator. Part of it is above the equator, part of it is below the equator. It is one of the largest countries in the world with 110 million people, the fourth largest in terms of population on the African continent. It's the second largest in terms of area. And it is the only country and on the continent that has nine other countries bordering it. So it's really the fulcrum on which the continent swings. So it's strategically located, so it's part of its importance in the heart of the African continent. And it's spectacularly wealthy. People are familiar with the natural resources in the Congo, or they've heard about it, where they say you know, economists say Congo's natural resources amount to the GDP of the United States, gross domestic product, around $24 trillion or so, right? But that's just natural resources. If you were to not even extract any minerals from the Congo, according to the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations, it has the agricultural capacity to feed an estimated 2 billion people. That's more than the population of the African continent as a whole. It has the hydro capacity, should they choose to leverage it, to provide energy or electricity for the entire African continent, Southern Europe, and Western Asia, the so-called Middle East. So the Africans controlling the Congo it's indispensable, let's say. The control of the Congo for the benefit of Africans being indispensable for the development of the African continent. And that was the vision that Kwame Nkrumah and Patrice Lumumba in particular, but also Modiba Keita and Ahmed Sekou Touré and even Frantz Fanon had for the Congo, for it to be in the control of African hands. Now, unfortunately, they weren't the only ones who recognized the centrality and importance of the Congo. But the Congo's and Africa's enemies also recognize that. As your listening audience may know, Patrice Lumumba was overthrown by the Central Intelligence Agency in 1960. At the time, it was the largest covert action in the world to overthrow a democratically elected leader. And the chief of station of the CIA, his name is Larry Devlin, he wrote a book entitled Chief of Station Congo. And, you know, Devlin said that we had to overthrow Lumumba because if we didn't overthrow Lumumba, not only would we have lost the Congo, we would have lost all of Africa. So both the revolutionaries, the Fanons and the Nkrumahs, right, even the likes of Che Guevara, who went to the Congo in 1965. If you read Che's diaries, he said that, you know, Congo's challenge, or where Congo is on the front lines of the combat against colonialism and imperialism. So if you look at these revolutionary figures, they center the Congo. If you look at the enemies of the Congo, like the Larry Devlins, the CIA, they center the Congo. They just center the Congo for different reasons. One group centers the Congo as a part of the liberatory undertaking, and the other group centers the Congo in order to staunch and disrupt that liberatory march or that march towards sovereignty. So, and then, you know, Chairman Mao, he took it to a whole other level. Chairman Mao famously said that he who controls the Congo controls the world. Mm-hmm. And you can make an argument for that, but that's a bit of hyperbole. But the fact that you could even make that argument about it gives you a sense of the centrality of the Congo. Now, for us, people of African ancestry, Congo bears a particular place in our history, right? Especially over the last 500 years. If you were to look at the last 500 years of our, the tragic part of our history, right? We see at certain key periods throughout that 500 years where Congo has loomed large, right? So if we look at the trafficking of Africans by Europeans to the Americas, which started really around the early 1500s, right? The early 1500s and the trafficking, according to UNESCO and Emory University has what they call a slavery database, slavevoyages.org for people who want to check it out. They say that almost half of the Africans that were trafficked from the continent came from West Central Africa. And that's the Congo Empire, the Congo region, stretching from Angola all the way up to the Cameroon. So almost half the Africans, specifically 4 out of 10. So when we talk about this devastating period in our history, it is that part of the continent that suffered the most from the extractive process, right? That extractive process on a part of the European powers that served as the fuel for advancing capitalism, right? And this is documented by a number of authors. If you look at Eric Williams, where he writes Capitalism and Slavery, talks about how slavery was key for advancing capitalism. Or even there's a Harvard professor, his name is Sven Beckett, who wrote a book called The Cotton Empire, or The Empire of Cotton, where he delves into the centrality of the labor intellect coming out of Africa in order to advance capitalism. Now, when you get to the industrial phase of capitalism, right, in the 1800s, we see Congo looming large again. 1884, 1885, European powers gathered in Berlin under the auspices of Otto von Bismarck, where they met for the Berlin Conference. Now, that Berlin Conference was also called the Congo Conference. And that's where European powers, including the United States, gathered to establish their spheres of influence on the African continent. They are moving from slave labor to the industrial phase. There's just this magnificent pie, they call it. And in order for them not to go to war against each other, they gathered around a table and say, well, you know, France, you get this part of Africa. Spain, you get this part. You know, Britain, you get this part. So that's why you have, you know, English and German and Spanish and Italian and Portuguese and French being spoken on the African continent, as these European powers came together to establish their spheres of influence so that they wouldn't go to war against each other. And a really good book to read to get a sense of this is a book called The Race to Fachada by David Levering Lewis. He's probably the foremost biographer on W.E.B. Du Bois. Right, but he also wrote about colonialism and the scramble for Africa, and the Race to Fachada is a part of his work. So, but something special in particular happened at the Berlin Conference. A lot of countries, European powers, came out of the Berlin Conference colonizing different parts of Africa. However, Congo wasn't colonized coming out of the Berlin Conference. Instead, Congo was given to King Leopold II of Belgium as his own personal property. So it wasn't a colony of the Belgian state. It was private property of the Belgian king, King Leopold II. And he ruled Congo for 23 years, right? From 1885 to 1908. And during that 23-year period, he extracted rubber and ivory ostensibly to power the automobile bicycle industry in the West. So here we see the trend, right? The narrative continuing. Human resources to power Western capitalism through the plantation slavery system. Industrial phase, natural resources to power particular industries in the West, to advance capitalism and technology in the West. And what comes with this extractive process, whether it's the extraction of human beings, extraction of natural resources, is the devastation of the people and the environment. So during that 23-year period, Congo's of the extraction of the rubber and ivory, Congo's population was decimated by half, right? Estimated 10 million Congolese perished. A professor that's right there near you at Berkeley University, Adam Hochschild, he wrote a book, King Leopold's Ghost, where he documents this, right? The role of King Leopold in destroying or basically instituting a slave economy in the Congo to the detriment of the Congolese people, right? Now, what is particularly interesting, wherever you have, of course, this deep extractive process, you also have resistance, right? So, but not only were the Congolese resisting, right, the hold on the Congo by King Leopold II, but African Americans, right, were joined in concert with their Congolese brothers and sisters to resist as well. So you have a figure like George Washington Williams, for example. Right? George Washington Williams was a Civil War hero in the United States. He fought for the freedom of Black folks in the U.S. After the Civil War, he went to study at Howard Universities and a few other universities, became an elected official in Ohio, one of the foremost African-American historians, John Hope Franklin, wrote a book on George Washington Williams entitled The Biography of George Washington Williams. George Washington Williams himself is, in some circles, is referred to as the first African-American historian of note, right, in the United States. So George Washington Williams, heard this narrative coming from King Leopold, because King Leopold, when he captured the Congo, he said he's going there to civilize the people. It's a civilizing mission. Remember, the European colonization of Africa was based and grounded on the rationalization of what they call the three C's, right? The arguments that Europe made for exploiting and capturing the continent. They said, well, we're going there to bring civilization, right? That's what King Leopold said. And he said, well, we're also going there to bring Christianity, right? The second C. And then the third is commerce, right? Because even Congo is referred to as a Congo Free State, which has allowed free movement, of commerce and people, Europeans throughout the Congo Free State. It was free for Europeans, but it was a slave dungeon, right? A slave plantation for Congolese, right? For Africans. So in any case, George Washington Williams said, well, I want to see what's happening in the Congo. So he actually got up, in 1890 and went to the Congo, right? This is African-American, 1890, traveling to the Congo after hearing the stories coming out of there. And when he got to the Congo, he said, what is unfolding here, for all intents and purposes, are crimes against humanity, right? So at the forefront of the resistance against King Leopold and his ownership of the Congo, African-Americans like George Washington Williams. They also had figures like William Shepherd and Lucy Gant, who were Presbyterian missionaries who went and they documented the atrocities that were taking place in the Congo and got it out to the rest of the world. So people like Booker T. Washington, he wrote a piece called Cruelty in the Congo, right? Where he's getting this information that's being put out by other Black folks in the Congo. Got to Booker T. Washington, Mark Twain, he wrote a piece called King Leopold's Soliloquy. So you had this global movement at the forefront of which were African-Americans joining with some Europeans under what they call a Congo Reform Association, with a gentleman by the name of Roger Casement and Ed Morrell. They wrote Red Rubber, and they resisted. It's like really one of the early global resistance, human rights resistance effort that resulted in King Leopold II of Belgium having to give up the Congo, where he sold it to the Belgian state. So it wasn't until 1908 that Congo became a colonial outpost under the Belgians as a result of the king having to give up the Congo. So, fast forward to today, we see Congo still trapped in that paradigm, right? Where it's serving as an outpost for the extraction of natural resources. So as we advance in technology, as capitalism advances into the technological phase, the artificial intelligence phase, right? We see, again, Congo's cobalt, Congo's copper, Congo's coltan, all being fundamental drivers of this new, this what they call, often called the fourth industrial revolution, or this new era, right, of technology and hyper-capitalism. And true to its history, Congolese continue to pay a devastating price. So from 1996 to the present, estimated at least 6 million people have perished in the Congo as a result of the scramble, in part, for those resources. said, according to the United Nations, the deadliest conflict in the world since World War II. And it is the pursuit of these resources that that really everybody wants. So today, Donald Trump injecting himself in the Congo on December 4th in Washington, D.C., signing a minerals deal.
One second, Maurice. I want to pause you right there because I want to. Yes. I want you. I love when my guests and I vibes. Like, you literally just walked through all the questions and took me exactly to where I wanted to get right now. For those of you just tuning in, I'm talking to Maurice Carney, co-founder and executive director of the Friends of the Congo. And so that is exactly. Thank you. I wanted the establishment of the paradigm, and then I wanted to take it to today where that paradigm is still playing out. So where you were going, I believe, is that the United States and the Congolese government have announced that they're entering into a pact, for those who don't see, I'm doing air quotes, around mineral extraction. And so I want to, and that's tied to a so-called U.S., again, air quotes, peace deal between Rwanda and the Congo. So I want to play
today
this clip.
The United States.
Yeah, go ahead. Play the clip.
Today, the United States is also signing our own bilateral agreements with the Congo and Rwanda that will unlock new opportunities for the United States to access critical minerals and provide economic benefits for everybody. And we'll be involved with sending some of our biggest and greatest companies over to the two countries. And we're going to take out some of the rare earth and take out some of the assets and pay, and everybody's going to make a lot of money.
What I love about white supremacy and white people is they will tell you what they're about to do because they really believe they have a right to do it. I mean, and Trump is sort of the epitome of that. He said, we're going to take out the rare earth. This is what we're about to go do. I want to talk about this deal for a second, and then I want to get into the peace deal. I'm clocking our time. You're definitely going to come back. My commitment is that we're going to slowly educate my listeners, right, about what's happening. And I say all the time, we cannot organize adequately in the present if we do not understand our history, which is why I had you start there. But I want to talk about this mineral deal. There's some really important things here, right? But I want to start with what I think is the most important. Once this deal was signed, by the way, it didn't go through Parliament for my listeners, right? This was just done. An edict, if you will, went out to the Congolese people to stop their individual mining, which they don't really, right? I think the word in the article that I read about it, if I can find it, I want to give them credit, in Public Citizen, critical minerals and contested sovereignty inside the US-DRC agreement, pittance, that Congolese people put themselves in incredibly dangerous conditions to mine materials, to then send them to these global corporations for pittance. Mm. An edict went out that they have to stop this. Yes?
There's just so much.
Go ahead.
To unpack there.
Back to you now. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's so much to unpack there. Maybe probably best to approach it by giving people a sense of why Trump is engaged, right? And you know, that minerals deal, I know we're talking about Congo, but it connects directly right there to you in Berkeley, right?
I'm
in Berkeley, California.
Yeah.
Berkeley, in the Bay Area, sorry.
We're sort of proud about our town.
Yeah, sorry, in the Bay Area, right there in the Bay Area. Because one of the companies that is involved in a part of this deal is a company called Cobalt Metals. And Cobalt Metals is based in Berkeley, California. And the investors of Cobalt Metals are the likes of Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates and, you know, Michael Bloomberg, basically the billionaire class. So when Trump says everybody's going to, you know, benefit, it doesn't include the Congolese people and those miners that you brought up, the artisanal miners, because a part of the agreement that was signed on December 4th calls for the formalization of the artisanal mining sector, which is, on the face of it, it's a good thing. However, we have a situation in the Congo because of the extractive process in the heart of the mining district in the south, where you have most of the industrial mining taking place, where the copper and the cobalt is coming out. The billions and billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars of copper and cobalt is coming out, is not benefiting the local population. So the local population then, as a means of survival, have to go and dig for minerals themselves, right? And they account for about 10 to 20% of the minerals that are coming out of the Congo into the global market. Congo produces 70% of the world's cobalt. And cobalt is a key driver of this electric vehicles, this green energy transition, right? So if you add up all of the countries in the world that produce cobalt, they don't equal what Congo produces. So the artisanal miners are there digging to survive. And the city, there's a city in the Congo called Kolwezi, which for all intents and purposes is the cobalt capital of the world, right? And that city, where tens of billions of dollars are coming out from its surrounding, you know, to go out through the world, it is supported economically to the tune of 70% by the artisanal miners, not the industrial mining, right? So the small-scale miners, artisanal miners, as dangerous, as atrocious as the conditions are, that's what they have left. So when the Congolese government signed a deal with the U.S., a strategic partnership agreement on December 4th, they said, well, we're going to shut down the artisanal mining sector without consulting with them, without offering a transition to a different type of income generating activity. That created tension. They're working through it with the government, but it's emblematic of the overall partnership, the strategic partnership that the DRC signed with the US, in that they didn't consult the local population, right? Even for a deal like this, it didn't go through their parliament. And according to Congo's constitution, if there is an international agreement that the president is signing that would require changes to the laws of the Congo, then it has to go through parliament. So there's a group of attorneys, young attorneys in the Congo, who have taken a case to Congo's constitutional court to say this agreement that was signed by the president of the Congo with the United States did not conform to Congo's constitution. So it actually needs to be annulled. We don't think that it's not likely that they'll be successful, because we're talking about the United States government. They have a government department called the International Finance Development Corporation, right? It's the U.S., one of the U.S. government's investment arm. They invest overseas on the part of the U.S. government. They've already allotted $2 billion in a letter of intent for mining and infrastructure projects that are part of this strategic partnership agreement that was signed on December 4th. You have the trade, it's already on the tracks and it's moving. Now, why this deal? So the United States is in a race against China and other countries to secure critical minerals. The deal itself, the U.S. states it clearly, that this deal was established to secure critical minerals for U.S. military and commercial sector, right? That's the main purpose of this agreement. This extractive process. A second aim is to contain China, right? Because China controls much of these critical minerals in terms of having access to the critical minerals and processing up to 80%, coming out of the Congo, the copper and the cobalt, right? So it's the deal was established for the United States to secure its critical mineral supply chain. And this is not just a question for Congo or for Africa, but it's a question for the entire world, because we see as the U.S. secures these supply chains, then it strengthens its military that it uses to go into Venezuela and capture a president, that it uses to launch bombs on Iran and Nigeria, right? So Congo is serving as, if the United States can secure this, and cobalt is of particular importance to U.S. military and aerospace industries, right? We talk about cobalt being important to electric vehicles, to the green energy transition, but the most critical part of the cobalt is for U.S. military. And the United States, back in the early 1980s, like the U.S. doesn't produce cobalt, they have a cobalt policy paper where they secure cobalt in order for it to be housed in U.S. reserves, specifically for the U.S. military. So that's the primary concern, U.S. national security interests, U.S. commercial interests with companies like Cobalt that's there in Berkeley, other members of the billionaire class, friends of Donald Trump, like his finance campaign co-chair, a gentleman by the name of Gentry Beach, who's lined up to get access to coltan in the Congo once these deals are settled. There is an organization there, and back to Oakland in the Bay Area, by the name of the Oakland Institute. If you all don't know the Oakland Institute, highly recommend you check them out. They wrote a remarkable report entitled Shafted, The Scramble for Critical Minerals in the DRC. And they are at oaklandinstitute.org. Highly recommend that people read that report. So you really have Oakland and Berkeley going toe-to-toe, because Oakland Institute, right, they're challenging, you know, this extractive process, this hyper-exploitation, hyper-capitalism. And then right there in Berkeley, you have cobalt, right, metals, financed by Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and other members of billionaire class. So it's not only a global issue, but it's all a local issue taking place right there in the Bay Area. And certainly Silicon Valley is very much engaged in this issue, because they need those resources in order to power their industries, their devices, the chips. There's some amazing workers in the chips and semiconductor industry who have taken up this issue, and they want to know what's happening to the workers at the bottom of the supply chain. Will we get these minerals for to produce our chips, right? So you have the workers in the semiconductor industry. You have the researchers and activists at Oakland Institute, all locally being engaged in this issue. And now we're so glad to have you, Kat, you know, on the media end. Of course, we got to give shout out to some of the other folks at KPFA over the years who've just been, you know Walter and Turner. Sabrina and Anne, yes. You know, all of those folks that they've been highlighting this issue as well. That's the lay of the land in terms of this deal. It's a deal that's worth potentially worth trillions of dollars, and it's being presented as a deal that's going to bring peace to the Congo. Congo has suffered 30-year war of aggression and plunder from Congo's neighbors, Rwanda and Uganda, who's been backed by the United States in terms of arms, financing, intelligence, and even providing diplomatic and political cover when international bodies try to bring them to book. So the United States have been very much implicated in this war of aggression against the Congolese people that Donald Trump now says he's coming to bring peace, when the U.S. has been a part of the problem, you know, from day one through its support of Rwanda's President Paul Kagame and Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni. Hope that gives people a sense, anyways, of what's at stake, who the players are, the resistance that's taken place here in the United States and in the Congo itself, and the significance, as I stated at the start of the program. This is wealth that's now going to be captured by the U.S. for the benefit of the U.S. military, benefit of the U.S. commercial, as opposed to wealth that'd be used for the development of the African continent.
Thank you, Maurice. We've got like 4 minutes left, so I'm trying to figure out where to go in such a short amount of time. I do want to refer folks back to the Oakland Institute. It's one of the places I went to prepare for our conversation, and they released a press release on October 21st of last year that says a failed U.S. brokered peace deal was never about peace in the DRC, that it was always about where we've landed now with this mineral extraction deal. I don't think we have to, I'm going to ask you now in front of everybody. I want you to come back next week because I don't want there to be too much space in between the conversation that we have. I feel like we set the context, we set the setting. Next week, I want to come back and I want to talk about the violence on the ground and how people understand what is happening to the people of the Congo. It's part of why I also wanted to talk about what surrounds the Congo, because I think also like where the fighting is happening is important. So that's what we're going to talk about next week. I'm going to give you the last 2 minutes for a call to action for people that are going to follow this series and that are like, I want to do something about what is happening in the Congo. What should they do?
Yes, thank you for that. Thank you so much, Kat, for inviting us on to be a part of this this discussion. And it's so critical for people to understand there's something for everybody to do. And the Congo, I hope I've laid out how it has affected each and every one of us historically and contemporarily, right? I mentioned Frantz Fanon earlier. Frantz Fanon said that, let us not forget, right? This is the Martinican philosopher, revolutionary, who wrote Wretched of the Earth and Black Skin, White Master, the whole bit. He said that the fate of all of us is at stake in the Congo, right? Each and every one of us, the fate of all of us is at stake in the Congo. Therefore, each and every one of us can do something. We cannot, that violence that you talk about, the 6 million dead, hundreds of thousands of women raped, it's our responsibility as human beings, Kat, not to normalize the situation, right? Not to normalize the rapes and the killings and the exploitation. So how do we not normalize it? Several ways. One, we learn about it. It's important for us to learn about it. And we encourage people to go to freecongo.org, freecongo.org. We have fact sheets there at freecongo.org. We have a primer that gives you like a basic of the Congo. So that's one way of not normalizing. And you learn about it, please share the information, right? Share the information with your friends, your family, your loved ones, your network. And when there are ample opportunities for you to do that on our social media channels. We're on X, we're on Instagram, we're on Facebook, we're on YouTube. We're on all of those platforms at Congo Friends. So if you go to those platforms and you type in at Congo Friends, you'll get our site will come up, especially on Instagram. Well, that's probably our most active, where we're producing information. So share that information.
Right? And we'll put all of those on our website. I've got to cut you off there because I got to get to my Resistance and Residence segment.
Okay.
But please, we will talk next week, I hope.
Maurice, thank you. Free Congo, freecongo.org. Thank you, Kat.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.